Hi everyone, I'm Pamelia Chia and you're listening to the Singapore Noodles Podcast, your go-to destination to learn about Singaporean food culture. Today I have on the show Marcus Liao, who is a chef and head of product development at Naked Fin, where he breathes new life into traditional flavors and heritage ingredients. In this chat, he talks about his Peranakan heritage and how modernization can be a way to keep traditional food alive. At the end of the conversation, he also shares his favorite places to eat at in Singapore. Could you tell me how you got started with cooking and how you decided that you wanted to be a chef?
I mean, growing up, it's like a typical like Peranakan household. Like I wasn't interested in like cooking when I was very young. You get very like drawn into the whole like smells and everything in the kitchen, because like growing up, it's very common for me to like go to my grandma's house, and then we would have like our typical. Like every week we'll go down and we have like just like those like Taochoo stews, and we'll do like sometimes we'll do like hammer the like bacalao. Last time you couldn't get the bacalao available in flesh, so that's the whole day we just spend like hammering out the stuff, the bacalao shells and everything. So but the thing is as I got to like army, I would say I kind of was actually more interested in baking, which is actually it's not very common, I would say, for like guys to be interested in pastry and stuff. But then as I got on to like when I actually got very quite determined, I actually decided not to go to like university, and I actually decided to just work in the kitchen. They didn't have any open slots. I worked in like a cafe. I picked a cafe where they would actually make like a lot of things from scratch, and they didn't have like a slot for like pastry and stuff, so they just put me at like the cold side doing like salads and stuff. And slowly while we were there, like you get very attracted to like what they were cooking like over at the other sections. And I guess like slowly I got more and more interested, and yeah, after that after a while I really wasn't interested in pastry anymore, I guess.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I feel that pastry is so unorthodox for guys to get into, right? Because it's seen as like a kind of feminine domain. So why were you interested in it in the first place?
To be very honest, I thought that it sounds very shallow, but I thought that like if I bake stuff, like girls would be more interested, I would say. Yeah, no, it's very, very shallow, but like when I was during the time where I started to bake, it was a very big thing to do like macaroons and you know all that stuff. So it was, at the point of time, it was like damn trendy. So I thought that I think it's very interesting. And at the point of time in school, I did like triple science and stuff. And baking is almost, it's very specific. It's almost like a science, like with like the measurements and everything. So I think that was also the part that kind of like drew me to like doing the pastries and stuff. So I guess like after a while I got more and more interested, and yeah, it's shallow as it sounds. This was like one of my earliest earliest memories of like actually doing something like to cook alone without like my grandparents or like my dad.
Oh, that's interesting. But it's so true, you know, it's so linked to chemistry. But what about kueh? You know, kueh is also desserts, but do you think it's more about the, you know, like guesstimation, just like cooking, or do you think it's very similar to pastry making in that it's really precise?
For kueh, it's a lot to do with guesstimation. With like my grandmother doesn't really do a lot of kueh. With like when I was young and stuff, but how to say, like even with like recipes that you see online and stuff, even though like it's very specific measurements, a lot of things are actually very like based on guesstimation. And let's say like if you do like kuehs, most of the times they don't really do things like over the bain marie. A lot of times they actually just like over the stove, you directly cook like the custard and stuff. And like obviously like a lot with the kind of things, a lot of things can go wrong, and you can't really like look at like a recipe and cook something like that at the same time. So I think it has a lot of guesswork. But as a chef, when we start to think about stuff like kuehs and stuff, we try to make things very consistent, because like I mean every for us to sell it, like to have people to come and eat all the time, obviously like things have to be very consistent, and we gotta think of a bit more modern ways to make it to make like every day like the same, especially when like in the future when I make quiz and stuff, like you wouldn't be there like all every day to like to oversee the process and stuff. So I think as much as I think like guesstimation it's a very hot site chef to do, but I think for in terms of like consistency wise you really need to be a bit more precise, I guess. Yeah.
And you also use vegetables in your kueh, right? And I guess that kind of throws off the precise nature of a recipe. So how do you cope with that? I know that you incorporate things like Jerusalem artichoke into your kueh.
With that, we always try to get from the same supplier, and with like the supplier that we get from, they all have been with our company, Naked Fin, for a very, very long time. So we would actually, they are very nice. They are like, they are the kind of suppliers where they would go to markets and get stuff for you. So there are certain things that we will look out for, like, like when we order the Jerusalem artichokes, we want the fatter, starchier ones. So, I mean, like with these kind of things, you can get very consistent produce, but obviously things like starch content, especially with like Jerusalem artichokes, the starch content is like different with like different times of the season. But if you have like a proper recipe, and then we always do like little test batches, yeah, to make sure that everything turns out very consistent. Because like with stuff like we are doing stuff like Jerusalem artichoke kueh or like corn salad, there really isn't this. You can't really like Google these kind of things. So you just have to do trial and error, and especially like now it's. In Singapore, I would say it's much easier to get really, really good kueh. I mean, from like Chalk Farm or even like online, there's so many like people like doing like home baking. So people have, in terms of kueh, people tend to be a bit more, they tend to eat more often nowadays. So they really know like what they want in a kueh, or like what's a good kueh, or like what's a like not so good one. So I guess like the fear of being judged like by kueh grandmas. I think that still scares me to this day. Because they're still currently serving like the corn salad at Magic Square.
Mm-hmm.
So every now and then, when like we get like an old like lady who's like a pranakan and that kind of thing, it still makes me really, really nervous. Because kueh is very subjective, right? Some people, especially with like salad, some people like the rice to be harder. Some people like the rice to be softer, or like some people like it to have like a hint of salt and stuff. It's not that easy sometimes, but with like we are very lucky that we get good suppliers, and so far whatever we've been getting like J-chokes or Jerusalem artichokes or like corn, they have been very consistent so far. But the initial process, it does take us a very, very long time to actually think of a proper recipe.
And in terms of texture, is it very similar to the traditional kind of kueh? Or is yours like the more modern, more silky kind of kueh?
For the Jerusalem artichoke ones, I would say, I mean, bingkak ubi and kueh salad are like one of my favorite kuehs ever. That's why I've tried to make different variations of it. And for like the bingkak ubi, I've always realized that like if you eat it, if you make it like after maybe like a few hours, or if you put it in the fridge, the tapioca starch starts to like gelatinize, and then it gets really, really chewy. So I thought like if I had like a different kind of starch inside to give it like a bit more structure, but at the same time, if it's not the kind of starch that like hardens a lot, maybe it will make it softer. So I started thinking about alternative starches, and at that point of time we were fooling around with like different starches, and we happened to hit like a season where Jerusalem artichokes were like much more affordable. And I really, really like I like Jerusalem artichoke because the flavors are very like savory sweet, and I think that's the kind of flavor profile which I think a lot of Singaporeans actually appreciate, especially with like a lot of our food and our cuisine. So I thought like it'd be an interesting idea to do it, and when we made it, obviously like in the beginning it was either too soft or too hard, but it was pretty promising, I would say. And then we paired it with like an ice cream that we made. It's like a brown rice amazake that we ferment ourselves. It really tasted like a very funky pulut hitam, which was something that was very unexpected. So when we paired it together, it It's one of those like kind of familiar but not familiar, which is what the kind of food that I kind of for now I like to kind of make. So it has like a little connection, but at the same time it's the context isn't really very obvious. Yeah. So just yeah, and especially with with the corn salad, we ate like so many different kueh salads. And when we start looking at like other home bakers and kuehs, and you talk to like all the people that have made kuehs before, you start to realize like what are the points to look out for, I guess. And one of the very big things of it was actually like they didn't like air bubbles in the kueh. So obviously like in a professional kitchen we have like vacuum pack machines and stuff. So we started to like vacuum pack the custards and start to think about how to make the custard like really smooth, really soft, but at the same time, obviously it still like holds the structure and it doesn't like turn to liquid when you cut it and stuff. And I think one of the very interesting thing about kueh that blew my mind was we did like a Straits Clan pop-up at Magic Square. And at a point of time, Chef Damon was there and he was selling kuehs also. And they were obviously like, it's all like a group of like very old aunties and they were so proficient with like doing kueh. And then for dessert, we were doing the corn salad thing. Then they're just like, how you put corn in your kueh? So obviously like they were very like weirded out. But I realized that they actually did this thing where, because I would take like maybe half an hour to cut like maybe a 30 cm kueh. It take me forever because of like the marks on the knife and stuff. Then I saw that they actually cling wrap like their knives. When me and Desmond and Abel, all of us were like looking at it, just like, wow, it just, as a, I mean, we're all like Western trained, so it doesn't make sense that like by cling wrapping a knife, you could like cut through anything at all. But everything was like so clean. When they cut the long strips, they use like the knife with the cling wrap. And then when they cut the smaller ones, they would use like those Bengawan Solo, those happy birthday cake, yeah. Those kind of small little thing to separate. And everything was so clean, you know, they didn't even need to clean their knives and they took like probably like a quarter of the time where I took to cut the kueh. And oh, like, oh my god, and like that really like blew my mind.
Mm. You know, you said that you're Western trained, right? But you have this Peranakan heritage. And now I feel that there are more and more chefs trying to, you know, embrace their heritage and learn more about heritage techniques. So what really was the turning point for you?
It's very embarrassing to say, but for me, I've never really embraced a lot of like Peranakan culture. It has always been one of those where, I'll eat it at home all the time. And then I guess that after a while I got taken for granted. So after my grandma and my grandfather like passed away, we didn't have a lot of time to like eat those kind of Peranakan foods a lot because my dad works overseas. So that kind of became a bit more like you start to reminisce a little bit more for it. And even as a chef, when we were to do like staff meal, which is the only time where we could actually be sort of like creative at a point of time when we weren't like at a very high position. So like even at that point of time, I wouldn't even do Peranakan food because like, you know, you gotta blend the rempah, then you gotta cook it down, and then by the time everything is done, then it's like you there's no time anymore. Normally like staff meal is like those like one pot wonder. You throw everything inside a pot and then you just like get things done and then like tasty can already. So like it even then it hasn't really like crossed my mind like about it. But when we did Magic Square, our boss like Ken, he starts to like encourage us to think about like what's like a heritage background, because that would be something I would say is more innately, that will come more innately natural. And I guess it didn't occur to me that much. But the thing is, when we went to like Tekka and like the market and stuff, then some of the chefs that we went with, then they were just like, how come you know like what this does or like what that does? Then I just like, it's just one of those things like when I was young, like my grandparents start to like tell me about, but I didn't know that it was a bit like muscle memory, I guess. When we started looking at Peranakan ingredients and coming from like where I used to work at, like they would never use this kind of ingredients, but you could draw like a lot of like different like comparisons to like what it can be. I mean like Bacala, it has like a very unique like chocolatey flavor, but if you cook it in a very unique proper way or like in a very different way, it could actually taste a bit like very funky, like truffles and that kind of thing. I started to think about more about like Peranakan cuisine, and like Singaporean cuisine. And there's actually, and like my dad always works in like Indonesia, and we will go down to like Bintan and like Batam a lot. And there's actually a lot of like similarities, I would say, in terms of how they deal with like ingredients. Like over there, they do like rawon, where they do like bakalor into like a soup, which I also thought like, wow, like bakalor in a soup is like, it's like a mind-blowing thing. It's like, wow, so interesting, like you put in a soup. And like over here, they all over here, like when we go to, especially when we go to like peranakan restaurants, like my friends, like I think my all my there was one time we went to eat peranakan food, and then one of my friends actually just like, oh, like but peranakan food isn't everywhere. It's like all like the same stuff, you know, like they're all doing the same thing, which is, I mean, on some level it is true. But then I started to think about like, oh, like how come like every restaurant, like all the peranakan restaurants, I mean there are certain restaurants like maybe the Babi Ponte is nicer, or like the Asam Pedas is nicer than the other restaurant. But it's true, I mean they're all serving like the same ingredients, same dishes. So like that got me like thinking like, well, if I think it'd be very interesting if I could actually use like peranakan ingredients and actually pair it in like obviously like, in a different way, and use like a bit more of like my Western techniques in it. So that's when like we started to play around more with like peranakan ingredients, Singaporean ingredients, and try to see like how things move on. And yeah, so far it's been a very, it's a very interesting and very fruitful, right? I would say, yeah.
Yeah, I find it very interesting whenever I look at your Instagram and I see things like local ingredients but treated in a very Western way or maybe Japanese way. So you have things like your calamansi kosho and your petai miso, and I saw galangal oil and things like that. So what were some of the, more interesting discoveries that you have
I really like belimbing.
had?
It's a very native thing, I would say. But even like my helper in like Philippines, they would just eat it with like dip it in salt and stuff. It's super super like sour, and like it's very very tannic. Like gives a very weird like sensation in your mouth like after you eat it. We were just running out of the season for umeboshi, and then we missed the cutoff for umeboshi. But we had like but I ordered like a ton of like purple shiso leftover. So that was one of the ideas that we tried to play around with. We went to pickle like belimbing, like how you do with umeboshi, where we salt it and then we soaked it in like a solution with like sugar and like purple shiso. And the product that came out of it really looked like the little kamameshi, the little pickles that you eat with your rice. And it almost has like a very similar shape, just, I mean, it looks a little bit more star in shape. But the flavor was, it's very interesting because it's very, in the beginning, the sourness has been like tempered down to, it's like you can actually eat it as a snack, but at the same time you get very nice like shiso flavors. So when we serve that with like one of our fish dishes, a lot of people just like, oh, it's like very familiar, like this plum, like it's very nice. Then I just like, oh no, it's actually like, it's actually belimbing. And it's, yeah, it's one of those, it's a very very small thing that we actually did to it, but it actually turned out to be like a almost like a very different flavor profile, which kind of really pleases me as well. Like during my, I was supposed to do a last menu at Magic Square and I fell sick, so I couldn't really do it. So I had a batch of bacalhau miso that was like there for, I think, well, like a year, I think. So it kind of fermented and it became like this very very like deep flavored paste. We used it to make like just very simple madeleines for the end of like a petit four kind of thing. So it didn't, the thing was, while making it, there was obviously, it was very hard to manipulate the ingredient because like bacalhau has so much fat, and like you're putting it with like a madeleine dough where you need so much like butter and like brown butter, it messes with the structure. It's very interesting because it actually has like a very nice like sour note and almost like chocolatey in flavor without even like having to pair it with like add like chocolate in it. So it was just like the miso and like just a basic flour and madeleine recipe. It was a very simple thing, but I think it kind of at the same time showcased what kind of food and what kind of things that we were trying to do at Mag Square.
Yeah, I feel like bacalhau is such a tricky one. Like I was trying to include bacalhau as a chapter in my book, Where Market the Table, and it was just like so expensive to procure and then to soak, and then you have to like crack and extract. You just need to go through so many experiments. Was that really difficult? Like, was it very time consuming?
In the beginning, when we did the bak kut teh, I mean, we were very lucky that we actually, there was a supplier at Tekka that could actually get like without the shell. Because then I didn't have to go through like the whole process of like taking it out. And then like with by doing the shell thing, a lot of times when you open it, some of them are like rotten and,
yeah.
and then you spend so much money on it,
Oh my god,
then it's like
yes.
everything goes to waste. So like we're very lucky that we managed to find like a consistent supplier. But it does take a lot of trial and error because how to say, Peranakan people as a stereotype is that they're very like Italians, you know. Like, you know, when they go out and eat, then they just think like, oh, my grandma cooks the best like sotong or whatever. So it's very tricky to actually try to like experiment with Peranakan ingredients. So in the beginning when we were like people were asking us what we're planning to do, and then I would say like, oh, I wanna do like Peranakan ingredients and like pair it in a different way and try to like do new flavors with it, then people will actually go like, why would you want to like do this kind of thing if it's not broken, like why fix it, you know?
Yeah.
Then I just but it's just like not tired, man, every time eat the same thing, you know, that kind of thing. Especially with like bakla, it's something that people are very like, once you think about bakla, they just think like, okay, with pork or with beef. Like even saying to pair with like chicken pork is normal. When I pair with like vegetables or if I pair it with like squid, then people go like, oh, like it's a little bit weird. But I think the environment of Magic Square, the way it's being poised as a very, it's a bit more like adventurous, like experiment kind of flavor. I think it kind of makes Singaporeans a bit more like willing to try. Yeah, I mean whether they like it or not. I mean, obviously that's important as a chef, but I would say like getting Singaporeans for me to actually see like, especially like Peranakans, to actually try and eat the food. It's really, honestly, it's something that makes me like quite intrigued, lah.
Yeah. So the dish of baklot with Brussels sprouts, is it a vegetarian dish?
Yeah, it's a vegetarian dish. So we make like an emulsion that is made from baklot and kanatai.
Mm.
So it's very, very savory. And we just do like leaves of baklot that we cooked with leaves of Brussels sprouts that we cooked with the wok, and then we just dress it like a vinegar that we made with mealybug stems, kimcham.
So this journey of working with local ingredients, right? Has it been a challenging one? Because I know that there's not a lot of documentation. So I would just love to ask whether you feel that this is one of the hindrances why many chefs or many cooks are wary about exploring heritage ingredients and techniques.
I totally agree. So going back to like Magic Square, so we do like a 9-course menu, and then they priced it at like $78 for like consumers, which is like a crazy like affordable price. I mean, we could still use premium ingredients, but we can't use a lot of it. So it kind of forces us to use more of like local ingredients. And I mean, in the beginning for us, we were all like chefs that used to work at like very nice like Michelin star establishments. You know, you get like super fancy equipments, and your all the ingredients are like, well, from France and all that kind of thing. So when we were saying like use like local ingredients, all of us are like, huh? Like I think it's not doable. To be able to create like flavors out of local ingredients, it is very, very challenging, but it's something that I think everyone should, all chefs, to actually give it like a shot to actually try. The good thing is that heritage ingredients in Singapore are very cheap. So we could like, to actually achieve the same amount of flavor like with like a French ingredient is very expensive, but we could buy like a huge amount of it and like reduce it to intensify the flavor. And you can still bring like heritage flavors like to like the forefront, and still like, even though like you pair it with like expensive ingredients, you can still make like heritage ingredients are the hero of like a dish. And that is, yeah, I really think it's, even though it's difficult, it's definitely not like an impossible task for us.
You know, you should definitely write a cookbook, like one of those restaurant cookbooks with all these techniques and with all these local ingredients. I feel that there's no cookbook on the market right now for that. I mean, you always see restaurant cookbooks from the West, right? Applying all these cutting edge techniques to ingredients, but you know, you don't really see that for our local side of things.
Yeah, I mean, with local side of things, there really isn't a lot of like ingredients. Even with like I have a lot of like old Peranakan cookbooks. They also don't really talk about how to like really
process.
Treat an ingredient. Yeah, exactly. How to treat an ingredient properly. Every now and then, Chef Damien would come by, and he would talk to us about like, oh, have you tried this? Have you tried that? And like to actually have a conversation with him. Always like I always just learn like a new thing, and he would be like super passionate about like ingredients. And he like there was one time he came to Naked Fin, and then we would talk about. He was just like, oh, like it's very interesting, like what you're doing. And then we would talk. And he just like, oh, have you tried this? Have you tried that? And then he just like, I just like, oh, I never tried for chef. Then he just like, oh, I'll bring it to you. Then the next day he shows up at like the restaurant at like what 9 a.m. 9:30, and then he just brought like a huge plastic bag of like ingredients, like different gingers,
oh, wow.
Like sprouting coconuts and that kind of thing. And it was like, and he would actually like roughly go through like the method of like how to process certain things. Even though he's doing heritage cuisine, he's still learning like using like interesting ingredients to actually bring about like different flavors out of something. Like he would talk about like white mangoes and like all different ingredients, which I've only seen like a few times. That being said, there really isn't a lot of people this kind of like chefs or people with like that much knowledge. Mm. And it's a good precursor to pave the way for like young chefs. They're starting to get a lot more dishes that are lost now in Singapore, I would say. Like I really like to eat sashima. It's like a little fried batter thing that they cook with like syrup, and then they cut into like square blocks, and it's like super. It's super tasty and it's damn sweet, but like it's very hard to find like this kind of thing now because it's so labor intensive. But if we could actually like learn about like the processes to make it, and actually try to apply like a modern technique to do it, to actually, but obviously not to like make a deconstructed version or whatever, but it's just obviously to improve the process to actually keep this kind of like heritage dishes, heritage snacks alive. I think that is something very worthwhile. I mean, this is our identity, I would say.
Do you think the reason why a lot of these heritage dishes are disappearing is because flavor and texture preferences have changed along the way? Like, for example, you know, in the past, we have things like, lao puo bing, right? Which you have winter melon kind of filling, kind of like a jam. Mm. And I feel that a lot of young Singaporeans are not into that kind of thing, that kind of dry texture, you know? So do you feel that that is a contributing factor?
Now Singapore is like a food hub. There is so many cuisines. You can just go out, not even like walk up to a restaurant. Like even on Grab, there's like easily like 7-8 cuisines that you can order like as takeaway. So I mean, I guess that kind of like does change people's flavor palettes and like what they want. And obviously, especially with like Instagram and all these kind of things, people always will, nowadays, even in like restaurants, there has been like a shift on like to create like more like umami flavors instead of this kind of, to actually think about like the flavors of the past. And yeah, I think there are still a lot of people that are like, even with the whole thing about like people selling kuehs online, I think that also shows that there is a like a resurgence, so to speak, of like this kind of dishes or this kind of snacks that will bring about nostalgia. But I wouldn't say it's happening at a very fast rate. But I do. I'm actually still pretty optimistic that like dishes like lao po ping will still be like around in like maybe the next few decades, I would say. But with that, obviously, like people palates do shift. But I mean, I think that there's nothing wrong with, like let's say like if there ever is like a lao po ping in a more like modern kind of flavor, I honestly don't think that it's like bastardizing like a recipe or something like that. But I would say that's also a way of keeping up with like times and like moving forward, but at the same time still being very we are very reminded of like our roots and stuff. So even if let's say like you do like a lapo ping with like maybe what's very trendy now, like salted egg yolk or something inside. Correct. But the thing is like people, but even if you sell this kind of flavors, then if like people go like, oh, like I'm very sure people will go like, oh, like I wonder what like the previous flavors like were with a lapo ping, and they would be, and even if like people actually sell in, like original stuff side by side, it will still be very, it will still start to get like conversations, I would say. Like with kuih, now there's like, now people, like a lot of people are still, you have like so many flavors of like kuih nowadays, but people still, the ones that get sold out very often are the, are still like the traditional flavors, like just normal kuih salad, but like just done very, very well. Or even like just like the best angku kuih or like pingka ubi, even like the original flavors are still the best. So even though like we modernize flavors, I feel that as long as like, even though like there's a lot of modernizing of flavors, as long as it's part of the conversation, I feel that we are still going on the right track.
That's so true. Like I feel that, so when I moved to Melbourne, there's this restaurant called Sunda, you probably know it. So there's this dish on the menu that is the buttermilk roti,
with
right?
The Vegemite. Yeah.
Wow, when I first tasted it, I was like, oh my god, it is worth the price tag. It's like 30, I don't know, I think it's 30 something.
Wow.
And I was like, I've never tasted prata in such a, you know, in such a way that is so flaky, so crunchy. Even when I tapao and I brought it home, it was still so good. And I was like, wow, this really reignites an interest in me to want to learn how to make prata properly. So I definitely resonate with what you're saying. We have dabbled with quite a lot of cuisines in your cooking currently at Naked Skin. But are there any aspects of Singaporean food that you would love to explore?
I've actually never really dealt with like Chinese cuisine, which is a very weird thing to say. Yeah, because before we went to like Magic Square, we were helping out at Naked Fin for the time being, and the chefs were all like mostly like Malaysian, as you would with like a lot of the kitchens in Singapore, and like their staff meals are all like very homely, and they'll make like sweet and sour pork, or like they'll do like those very nice like soup and stuff. I mean, I do have that at home, but the way, I don't know, but the way they cook it is very, very different, because I guess it's because they're obviously more in tune to like Chinese food to us. So they probably like, they know like little tricks. Like before I actually worked at like Naked Fin in other restaurants, I wouldn't even know what like velveting like was, where you do like cornstarch and kind of, I would never know anything of that. And then when we start to, and then they would like, they would do like fish with like gangzhen, which is just like soy, water, and sugar. But I just like, oh, that's all, oh, this is like damn tasty. Like, what is this? And they just like, then they just look at me like, you know, like crazy. I don't know what it is, that kind of thing. Just like, oh, just water and soy sauce. But it's, to me, it's not a very innate thing for me to understand. Cause like, even for Chinese New Year, I don't eat pen cai. Like for Chinese New Year, we do like bak lao. And then my grandma would do like zap chai and just like throw a bunch of like fa chai inside. And then that would be like our pen chai. So all these kind of things isn't very like something that comes to me very naturally. So I think that would be something very interesting. I mean, like there's like hakka, you got like the what? You got like suang panzi, and then you got like lei cha. The kind of, because I always go to like markets at like Geylang Serai or like Tekka. But like, I think in the last, I think maybe 4 or 5 months, I've actually went to like Chinatown markets a bit more often, and like you got those like stalls just selling like a ton of like herbs and plants, and like to actually ask them why it is, they actually can't really like tell you why it is. They just like, oh, you cook this in water, it's good for your stomach, or like, you know, like they can't really explain like in terms of like flavor profile, or like, obviously cannot because like this kind of thing, it's a very
abstract.
It's a very hard thing for people. Yeah, exactly. It's a very abstract thing for people to actually like pin down what the flavor is. So it's really, I think that is one of the aspects where I would want to like explore more. Even like, I'm very embarrassed to say, like I didn't know that like grass jelly literally came from like a little plant. Yeah, because I just thought like, oh, it was like maybe like it has like natural like gelling properties that it became like a block of jelly or something. But to actually see those kind of ingredients firsthand, it's very interesting, and it's something that I will want to try to use, I guess. With the new Magic Square, the chefs, they're all like have a Hakka and like Hokkien heritage. So when we do like food tastings with them, I honestly get intrigued sometimes because they're just like, I made my own five spice because like, you know, I didn't like the nutmeg flavor in the five spice. Then I'll be just like, oh, I didn't even know there's a nutmeg in like five spice, you know. So it's like little things like that, just like it does like intrigue me like a lot, and it's something that I want to explore.
Yeah, I love that so much. I was talking to Gerald Ong, who is a chef based in Canberra in Australia, and he was talking to me about his experience working in a Chinese restaurant here, and he has like a sifu and everything, teaching him how to use the wok and like velveting. And the first time I tried velveting, I was like so mind blown, you know. I was like, oh my god, it tastes exactly like the zi-cha, you know, down the road. But we never ever think of using such techniques at home. What about cuisines like Eurasian cuisine or like Indian cuisine? Do you feel like kind of like locked out of these cuisines?
So I guess like using for like Eurasian ingredients and Indian ingredients, it's something that I really very out of touch with. But I think, but we're very lucky lah. Like there's a lot of like if you go down to talk to like the vendors or like the people that are selling all the stuff, they actually will tell you about it.
Yeah.
Even though like it's not, obviously it's not very like specific. But we like when you read about like making curries from scratch or like certain dishes, they have this thing called like asafoetida. So I would just like, oh, like what is it, you know, like it's just so complicated. Then when you tell people, or like even with like green gooseberries that you see in those like Indian stores, when you ask them, just like, ah, to cook curry. Then like, or like what is the spice for all to make you to cook curry also. So it's like you obviously like you get very like, huh? Like everything to cook curry, then it's like what kind of like flavors or what kind of ingredients can I do with it? Then obviously it gets a bit like frustrating, but it doesn't. It's interesting to actually try it and to go like, oh, actually like asafoetida has like this like very garlicky flavor, or like even like green gooseberries are like almost as tart as like belimbing. I do feel obviously like in the beginning I do feel at a bit of a disadvantage because like, I obviously haven't really like eaten a lot of this kind of food. But going back to like the Singaporean heritage and cuisine, I think that's what makes us like Singaporeans like really lucky. Even like to actually, if we ever have the opportunity to look in inside rather than look out, you actually realize that there are a lot of like interesting ingredients, just that they've always been just done one way, and they haven't been really thought about doing it another way. So actually to actually start to think about all these kind of things could really be, you never know, you might actually like come across like a gold mine, like just to cook just in another way. So I think it's for the new chefs that are more hungry, and nowadays like it's much more easier in Singapore to like, you know, like do a host a pop-up or like do like home dining. I think that kind of hopefully that gives like younger chefs more like more chance like to be adventurous and to actually eventually like want to use like local ingredients.
Actually that's so true. Like when I was younger, right, like I used to think that local cuisine was so boring, or like local ingredients was really boring, because if you were to ask me, local ingredients in my mind back then was like xiao bai cai gai lan. It's like so boring, right?
Yeah.
Then I started going to the wet markets, and like you start seeing things like moringa, you know, jambu or like roselle flowers, and I'm like, oh my god, it's really like a farmer's market, and we really have so much. What are your hopes for Singaporean food? How would you like it to evolve?
I would never want like hawker culture to like disappear, and hopefully, I mean, we do hear a lot of, like old people, like, you know, they cannot, the kids don't want to continue, and you know, they gotta close down their shops. But I mean, on the other hand, there are young people that like fresh out of like CIA or something, they want to open their own like bar chor mee store, or like it's not just like they're doing like some interesting Japanese thing in like hawker center. They actually want to do like bar chor mee and everything, and that's, I mean, you don't get a lot of these kind of people, but I think it's a good start. It'll always be nice to see like different tiers. I mean, obviously I wouldn't want, it's not just like I want like a fine dining Singaporean restaurant, but I think it would be nice to have like different tiers. Like you got like young chefs obviously like be more interested in like hawker culture. You have people, and I hope to see like a new kind of Singaporean cuisine? Like, have you checked out, like, let's say Desmond from like Tiffin, like he does like the Tiffins, but it's like it's still very, very different. Even like Minket from Master Seed, like, I always love like to go there, and he's always doing like very, very new. I mean, it's not easy to get a seat and stuff, but he's always doing like new things, and that kind of like does give me a lot of encouragement for like a chef. I mean, eventually, hopefully when I do get the opportunity to open my restaurant, I would want to be like him, in a sense, to like create, to be pushing like Singaporean cuisine forward. Like, whatever he's doing is not like like a very Singaporean thing per se. He's like mixing like his Japanese heritage, his Japanese experience from learning like with like Goto, and a bit of what he learned at Candlenut. But that doesn't mean that what he's doing is like not correct. I really still think that he's still pushing forward like Singaporean the narrative forward a lot. And I personally don't feel that it doesn't matter if, like, let's say you're doing like Singaporean with like a very Italian kind of like ingredients or something like that. I still think that is, as long as like Singaporean ingredients or like Singaporean cuisine is still part of the conversation, I still think that it's very much a success of moving Singaporean cuisine forward.
Yeah, and I think you're doing that in your own way as well. You know, like when I look at your dishes, you see a lot of influences from like hawker food and stuff. I saw your fish siu yok, right?
Yeah, correct.
That was so interesting. Yeah. And then the donabe, right, with a lot of Singaporean touches. So I thought that was really, really nice, you know, because clay pot cooking is like such a big part of Singaporean food culture. Yeah. So what are some of your favorite eats in Singapore?
I've mentioned Master Seed. It's really, every time I get an off day, because they have the same off day as us. So every time I get an off day, I try to see whether I can make a booking at Master Seed. I like Songki.
Is that Bak Kut Teh?
No. Songki is this place. They used to be at the east side. Now they moved to Ang Mo Kio. They make their own like her kiao. Cause I really like bak chor mee, and like they make their own her kiao.
They're at Joo Chiat, right?
Yes. Last time they were at Joo Chiat, then they moved to Ang Mo Kio, which is much further for me. But I still try to make time for it.
Yeah.
Cause like it's like dry noodles and then like her kiao. It's something that it's very comforting, like, for me. And even like they're not the best, but like spring leaf prata is like everywhere now. And a lot of people that know me, every time I on my off day, like, I must eat like roti prata. And then I always eat it in a bowl. Cause I'll put like so much like curry inside. Okay. It's not the healthiest thing.
Yeah.
But it's really one of those like comfort food, and something that I'm one of those people that can eat like prata and like bak chor mee like every day, which I actually tried to do last time, but it's obviously not healthy, like. But yeah, like this kind of thing, like bak chor mee, or like for us, even like other kind of cuisines, like Dongfang, so it's like China food. We like to eat China for like us chefs. We always finish work very late, and then we will eat like those kind of China food at night. And then, like, we'll be very inspired by, like, they got those little chuan chuan. They always put, like, those very, very interesting spices on top with those, like, little skewers of, like, meat. So it's, like, they're using, like, cumin, cardamom seeds.
Yeah.
But it's very, very interesting because, like, when you think about Chinese food, you don't really think about, like, that kind of thing. But it's more, like, it's, like, the Xinjiang, correct, the Xinjiang kind of aspect to it. It's very, it's something that resonates with, like if you compare it to like people, like the chefs using like vadouvan and that kind of thing, like it's a very French like thing to use like vadouvan spice, but there's a lot of similarities in it.
Yeah.
So it's very, very interesting. So it's like stuff like this is even though, I mean, it's tiring like to finish work, then you still eat something, then you still think about like food and stuff. But it's this kind of places that I can just eat this kind of stuff like every week.
Yeah.
And I still get like really, really very satisfied.
I love that they use a lot of offal. You know, that's the thing I love.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, very, very nice. Like, great talk with that. Very, very amazing.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. You know, it was so nice chatting with you. I can't wait to try your food one day.
Yes, please. Thank you for having me.
That wraps up another episode of the Singapore Noodles podcast. You have been listening to Marcus Liao, who is a chef and head of product development at Naked Fin. food media tends to focus on Singapore's best hits like chicken rice or laksa and fails to capture the diversity of Singaporean food. By documenting overlooked recipes, Singapore Noodles seeks to share about Singapore's rich food culture with you. Visit our website at sgpnoodles.com to get access to local recipes and video tutorials. We also have a newsletter where we share about the history and cultural context of local food at sgpnoodles.substack.com. That is SUBSTACK. Once again, thank you for listening to the podcast, and I'll catch you next week.